thought about how you want to be buried? You can go the traditional route or you can go green. There's a growing interest in having a natural chemical-free burial for a host of financial, environmental, and personal reasons. You can get wrapped in a shroud, be placed in a biodegradable coffin, and be buried in a cemetery that looks like a park. Your remains can become part of an artificial reef to create a habitat for fish and other marine life. You can be buried at sea, freeze-dried, or bio-cremated. Well, today on Radio Times, everything you need to know about green burials, and we have two guests who have joined us. Here in our Philadelphia studios is Mark Harris. He's the author of a book called Grave Matters, A Journey Through the Modern Funeral Industry to a Natural Way of Burial. He's a former environmental columnist with the Los Angeles Times Syndicate. And Mark Harris, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here.
And on the telephone is Billy Campbell. He's the founder and president of Memorial Ecosystems and Ramsey Creek Preserve, the country's first green conservation burial site. He's a family physician, also associate director of a local hospice in South Carolina, and he joins us on Radio Times as well. And Billy Campbell, nice to have you with us on the show.
We're glad to be here.
And let me start with you, Mark Harris. Are we witnessing a growing interest in so-called green burials?
I mean, I think we are. I mean, even some early surveys suggest that that more and more people are at least interested in going green. AARP did a survey back in 2007 that found that 20% of those who had heard about green burial said that they were interested in it. More recently, there was a survey by a cemetery group found roughly the same numbers. So those are pretty strong numbers for a movement that really just started back when Billy opened Ramsey Creek Preserve in 1996.
In fact, you did open this preserve back in the mid-90s. What was the impetus for that, Billy Campbell?
This is an idea I'd had since college in the 70s, and I think I've been a lifelong conservationist and a member of the Nature Conservancy, a life member, and had done some land donations, and I just recognized this was an industry that could potentially save tens of thousands, if not millions of acres, if done right. And but also the death of my father in the mid-80s was probably the thing that lit a fire under me.
And Mark, I have to say that Billy showed me some beautiful photographs of your, and do we call it a conservation burial site? Is that the appropriate word or series of words?
Yeah, that's what we're calling it to distinguish it from just the general idea of just natural or green burial. This is more about a site that's a functioning nature preserve.
Well, I should say it looks like a nature preserve.
Yes, well, it absolutely does, and we have over 300 species of vascular plants. We have an active restoration project going on in some wetlands that we bought recently. It has some rare trilliums growing there. So, yeah, it's managed like a nature preserve, and when people are buried, they actually we use that ground disturbance to introduce rare plants in some cases.
And what I saw were fields, woods, and very subtly, I guess, placed markers where the bodies are.
Yeah, correct. I mean, Ramsey Creek, there's a lot of surface stone, and those stones were gathered over the years for building materials and such. And when we put the stones back, we actually try to make it where it's habitat for lizards and actually ants that distribute a lot of the eastern woodland forbs, the little wildflowers. So we try to make the stones ecologically functional.
And do people, in a sense, dig their own graves? And I don't mean the dead people, obviously, but their family, friends?
Well, sometimes they do. We allow that. We've had several families do it. They have to do it under our direction. There's a very specific way that we have to do the graves where we don't mix the layers, where we save the, make sure that if there's any plants there, we rescue them on the site, and that we don't do a lot of collateral damage around the site during the dig. So if they help or do it themselves, it has to be under our supervision. But we have had families do it. More commonly, the families help us close the grave. That happens really frequently. We have a lot of shovels down, and the family will help close the grave and tell stories and cry. And I think it's very meaningful for them.
It sounds that way. And how many people are buried there?
I think I talked to Kimberly this morning. I think we're getting on up towards 300 people at this point.
And do people come there and use it like a park? That you know, they may not have somebody buried there, but want to walk the grounds?
Yeah, we had the South Carolina Association of Naturalists came up, scan, and and had an intense species finding project. We had spider people and flower specialists come up. We have a wedding Saturday. It's going to be the biggest wedding we've had. This will be our third or fourth wedding, I guess, but one small service. And we've also had a baby blessing. So this is more than just a place for people to be buried. It's for life celebration, really.
Well, Mark, let me go back to you. And, I mean, it sounds like what Billy Campbell is describing is the way we used to do burials, yes?
That's right. You know, what we now call green burial is really nothing more dramatic than or different than what we used to do, you know, in the founding years of this republic and many years after. Family members mostly died at home where bodies were washed and dressed by women of the house. Someone would be dispatched to call the carpenter who would build a plain pine box, or you might buy one at the furniture store. Someone would dig a hole in the back 40 or the community graveyard. There would be a service at the home around the body or at the graveyard, gravesite itself. The body was lowered into a hole in the ground. There was no chemical embalming of the remains, no burial vault, no metal casket hermetically sealed against the elements. The body returned to the earth and directly returned to the earth, nourishing the ground, pushing up vegetation, and really becoming part of the natural cycle of life.
So what changed that? Is there a short version of the history of the funeral business? No, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there were a couple of things that happened in the 1800s, the industrializing of the country, the rise of the middle class, but probably the Civil War was the most single important event. You know, most of the battles of the Civil War raged across battlefields of the rural South. Bodies were buried on or near the battlefield where they fell, sometimes in graves that were very hastily dug. Northern families who wanted to retrieve their slain family members would send emissaries to locate those remains, disinter them, or take them from hospital morgues, and they would place them in wood coffins and then put them on rail cars. You know, that journey north could be very long, and in the summer months, those bodies actively decomposed.
Indeed.
On the ride home, some to the extent where putrefying gases would build up within the coffin sufficient to explode it, something that became known officially as exploding casket syndrome. I mean, as a writer, you can't really make up a better phrase than that. So it was then that battlefield surgeons suggested embalming as a way of preserving remains for that long rail ride home.
And how common is that today?
Typically when we talk about the American way of death, which is what you get for the most part when you go to any funeral home, that's what happens. Mm-hmm. The body is, I mean, when we talk about modern burial, basically I'm talking about the body being embalmed, placed in a metal casket, since 3/4 of all caskets produced in this country are metal. And then at the cemetery plot, it's not a law, but cemeteries usually require the use of a burial vault.
And you have in your book, I have to say, very vivid descriptions of the embalming process. Yeah. I don't know how many people actually want to hear that, but nonetheless, can you just describe what happens when someone is embalmed?
I really walk you through in all of its glory, the embalming process. But essentially, it's looking to preserve the body for the short period where you could view it in a funeral home. So it's essentially, replacing the blood in the body with a formaldehyde solution to retard decomposition. But then really the more, I think, invasive procedure involves getting all the millions of bacteria that reside and thrive in our abdominal cavities. You know, early embalmers used to eviscerate the corpse, you know, the Egyptians, and take those organs and all of those compounds out. Modern funeral directors have used what they call a trocar, which looks a lot like an arrow with holes to the fore of the shaft. It's connected to a tube, and what the embalmer does is take that trocar and punches it into the belly of the deceased, and then, you know, quite literally punctures the organs and then vacuums up all the liberated material, which is then sluiced down the sewer. And then that area is then flooded with more embalming, a very astringent form of embalming compound.
And the idea is to make the body look presentable for a viewing?
That's right. Embalming does two things. One, it helps preserve the body and restore some life to it. So there's a difference when you look at it. And it also, these embalming fluids are filled with dyes, which give the simulacrum of a body, you know, just at rest. And that's the whole purpose. When you walk into the funeral home, it looks like somebody has just slipped off to sleep, not somebody who's passed away recently.
Well, Billy Campbell, let me go back to you. And I'm curious about the condition of the bodies that are buried at your conservation burial site. What do they look like?
Well, I mean, we're presuming that pretty rapidly that the bodies go back to nature. And the hope is, of course, is that some of the body's nutrients, some of the things that, of our body that could be of use to plants, et cetera, will go back up into the through the root systems into the trees. In our soils, we're in a very acidic situation from older bearers where they've had to move cemeteries when they built some of the lakes around here. The Corps of Engineers, they moved some cemeteries, and a lot of times it's just a dark stain and some teeth, and that's all that's left because, again, our soils are so acidic, and it's a warm climate. So presumptively, you know, we presume that's what's going to happen with the bodies at Ramsey Creek, and that hopefully a lot of what we are will end up being trees and flowers and that sort of thing.
Are people buried in biodegradable caskets? Are they buried in shrouds? What are the choices they have?
Oh, well, it's everything, including being buried just directly into the ground in street clothes with a piece of cloth over the face, which we actually consulted with the Monastery of the Holy Spirit in Atlanta, in Conyers, Georgia. It's a Trappist monastery, and this was very consistent with what they do. They actually bury... The monks are buried in their vestments just with a cloth over their face. And so we have had people to choose that. We've had people have organic cloth shrouds. We've had a lot of those. Probably the most common thing, those are plain pine box.
And do you worry about animals digging up bodies?
That comes up all the time. You know, burying people is a low-tech solution for that very problem, and it's one reason, I mean, you know, human burials go back millennia into a time when we had much larger omnivores like, you know, grizzly bears, you
right.
name it, out there, and it actually works very well to prevent that. We don't bury 6 feet deep. We bury more shallow than that, but there's at least 2 feet of dirt and a mound, at least initially. Sometimes if there's a casket, it can be more than that. Believe me, if you've ever hand filled in a casket in a grave like we do, you know there's an awful lot of dirt and rock that we put back into the grave. So we've not really had any trouble in 10 years. We've had no graves at all disturbed, and we wouldn't expect it any more than we expect with pioneer cemeteries. You know, there are a lot of examples of pioneer cemeteries that are great examples of tall grass prairie and are the nidus of state parks. And again, they didn't have problems, and they had a lot more wild animals.
Sure, digging at things. Well, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. Also want to open up the lines, and we are talking about green burials, and we're curious about how you are thinking about your burial or your funeral. I know that's not something that we necessarily like to do, but nonetheless, it's going to happen to all of us. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Joining us by telephone is Billy Campbell, the founder and president of Memorial Ecosystems and Ramsey Creek Preserve. That's in South Carolina, the first green cemetery in this country. And Mark Harris is with us as well. He's the author of a book called Grave Matters. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Trader Joe's, a neighborhood grocery store with a variety of seafood and meats for the grill, meat and vegetable marinades, and lemonades. Locations and more at TraderJoe's.com.
Imagine, if you will, listening to all your favorite WHYY FM programs without membership breaks, but knowing you support public media. Introducing YStream, a pledge-free stream of WHYY FM available during our October member campaign. Visit WHYY.org by October 12th, pledge $60, and receive your special link to listen to regular WHYY FM programs during our October fund drive. Need more information? Visit WHYY.org.
A premier talent of American theater discusses her latest role in a highly controversial revival of a classic.
Even though it is a glorious piece of work, a lot of people, especially African Americans, have a hard time coming to it. It's a double-edged sword.
Audrey McDonald on the musical The Gershwins' Porgy and Bess, a new adaptation of the 1935 opera. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Academic Urology is pleased to support WHYY. bringing together 36 Philadelphia area urologists. Academic Urology serves patients throughout the region and at 18 area hospitals. More information online at academicurology.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and in this hour of Radio Times, everything you need to know about green burials. And again, our guests are Billy Campbell and Mark Harris, and surprise, surprise, we got a full bank of calls here. But Mark, let me just ask you a question, and this goes to your the conclusions of your chapters in your book, Grave Matters, which is in many ways, and this surprised me, there aren't a lot of laws about what we can and can't do when it comes to burials. We probably have a lot more leeway and choices than we think we do.
That's right. In fact, when I first started working on this book, I was focusing on the natural options, which fill up most of the book. But I realized that we are so full of misinformation that I needed to sort of disabuse us as to what we think is required when death comes calling. So, for example, embalming is almost never required. Right. And then in most states, families can act essentially as their own funeral directors. They can hold home funerals. With the proper paperwork, you can transport the deceased to the cemetery or the crematory yourselves. And create your own, quite beautiful funerals and send-offs. We do have a lot of control over the care of our dead.
And can we bury people in our own backyard or?
That depends. Actually, in certain rural and agricultural zones of this country, backyard burial, rural burial is still a well-honored tradition and certainly happens. In fact, one of the chapters of the book, I find a man in central Virginia who buries his wife up on their mountaintop home.
Wow. Now, cremation I don't know how popular that is, but you also write about, environmentally speaking, I guess some of the pros and cons. Can you talk about that? And Billy Campbell, we'll get you back in on the conversation as
sure.
well.
I thought a lot about whether or not to include cremation in my green strategies. Yeah. So, but I do. I think that when you look at the goods and resources that are diverted to the production of that modern burial that we're talking about, and then the pollution that's generated as a consequence, and then you compare that to cremation, I think cremation stacks up pretty well. But cremation does, there is an environmental drag. You're heating a hearth to 1600 to 1800 degrees for 2 hours using natural gas, some little electricity, and you're releasing greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. The biggest drag is probably the mercury from the silver fillings of us baby boomers. That is only vaporized in the course of that incineration, and that mercury is then carried up the smokestack, caught by prevailing winds, deposited on ground and surface waters. Mm-hmm. The fish consume that mercury. It doesn't biodegrade. We consume that fish. We absorb.
But is there that much mercury have that much impact?
Well, it's not much, but even trace amounts have been shown to cause significant developmental delays. That's not regulated on the EPA level. The EPA compares it to other emissions of mercury, right, compared to, say, coal-burning power plants. So it is lesser in comparison, but it is still worthy of some consideration.
Billy Campbell, I'm just curious how many people at your site choose cremation?
I would say at least a quarter. We first opened and got going. We actually had a fair number of people who think the industry irreverently calls shelf people who had been cremated and were sitting on the shelf somewhere with nothing. Families didn't know what to do, and we do take cremated remains, and as far as the interment of the remains, of course, it doesn't take much effort to do that. And I think it is probably the second best thing environmentally after a natural burial. I'd say probably a quarter of the people have been choosing cremation.
And Mark Harris, can you scatter remains anywhere? Are there guidelines about that or even laws about that?
Well, there are laws, and then there are laws that people ignore. But, you certainly can't scatter or bury your remains on somebody else's land, but you can bury them and scatter them in your own backyard. If you're going into state forests or protected lands, you're supposed to get permission from the authorities to do that. Sometimes you even fill out a permit. You spend $25 to $50. And if you're going to scatter off the coast, you are supposed to go out, 3 miles and then dump them, essentially off the continental shelf. But of course, many people don't do that. Most people don't do that. And there are no cremated remains police out there making sure that people do it. And even if they find you, what are they going to try to, have you retrieve your scattered remains? I don't want to encourage people to break the law, but there are, uh, but you, uh, I guess I'm encouraging people to be wary at least, or considerate.
Well, let me ask you something about bio cremation. And I went online, and there's a company, I won't say the name, but they, and I'm just reading from their website, cremation by definition is reducing the body to its basic elements of bone fragments through the use of heat. The biocremation technology replaces use of flame with the utilization of water blended with this chemical solution.
Right.
How common is that?
Well, it's not happening yet. I mean, it actually did happen somewhat, I wouldn't say illegally, but an Ohio funeral home did biocremate 9 bodies before they were shut down. And we're about ready to roll this out. This procedure has been approved in 7 states, and it looks like a funeral home in Florida and outside Minneapolis are about ready to roll this out. Yeah, essentially the body's put in a steel chamber. Water is added, a number of gallons of water is added, potassium hydroxide. That chamber is heated, pressurized, and then you get, at the end, essentially what you get in cremation without all the smoke, without all the the mercury emissions, without that environmental drag. I think the issue with biocremation, though, is that, so you have the cremated, you have the bone, the families
yes.
can turn into cremated
yes.
remains, but you do have, you know, what I can only, I haven't come up with a word yet, you get this liquid aftermath. All that water has been, you know, heated, so what do you do with that? At this point, it's sluiced down the sewer, and so many people are indelicately referring to this as flushing grandma down the drain.
Oh dear.
So I think there is a disposal issue, or at least a perception of a disposal issue, that I think this industry is going to have to deal with before families fully embrace it. But I guess in some ways it is greener.
Billy Campbell, do you have any thoughts about biocremation, such as
the only thing is there's also the embodied energy of creating potassium hydroxide. The old production method used mercury-based cells, and actually did involve some mercury issues in the industrial process. But you know, that is an industrial process that I think uses a lot of electricity. So you know, to create the potassium hydroxide requires energy, and it's embodied in there. It may be produced somewhere else, but there is potassium hydroxide doesn't just occur naturally; it has to be produced.
I'm curious, Billy Campbell, also about you know, metal fillings, as Mark Harris was saying, you know, joint replacements, pacemakers. Are they buried along with the people at your cemetery?
Yeah, I mean, usually, like, a lot of times pacemakers can be taken out, but there's no way that we could realistically do things like hip replacements. And they are, hip replacements are inert. We're not really worried about that. We had one guy was saying that he was going to make sure that up in Canada that all the prosthetic things were taken out, and I said, well, that could raise some indelicate issues that with breast augmentation and other things. You're not going to want to say, well, gee, are those grandmas or not? I mean, it sounds silly and irreverent, mm-hmm. but I'm just saying that it's, practically speaking, there's just no way to do that, and if there's a little bit of extra this and that in the grave that doesn't really affect the environment, then I'm not going to make a big deal of it.
And that's Billy Campbell, the founder of the first green conservation burial site. It's called Ramsey Creek Preserve in South Carolina. He's a family physician, also associate director of a local hospice down there in South Carolina, joining us from South Carolina. Mark Harris is with us here in our Philadelphia studios, a former environmental columnist. He's also the author of a book called Grave Matters, A Journey Through the Modern Funeral Industry to a Natural Way of Burial. And yes, we are talking about green burials today on Radio Times. Let me get some callers in on the conversation, and it looks like we have Lauren from Philadelphia joining us. And Lauren, go ahead, you're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi there.
I'm a professional archaeologist, and I've probably excavated over the years some hundreds of burials and studied a considerable number more that I have not excavated, an activity that no one in our field undertakes lightly.
Yes.
And I had some observations that might be of assistance to you guys. I'm sure you've probably already figured a lot of these out. A long time ago, I did a study of Native American burials in Rhode Island, mostly to try and preserve whatever might remain at these sites. And it was a study that identified about 70 burials that had been historically excavated, found through road construction or building construction. And what I found was that there were a fair number of known historical cemeteries that were believed to contain Native American burials. There were a large number of contact period, which is to say 17th century burial sites with a large number of preserved burials. And then the further you got back into the past, the fewer there were.
Hmm.
And in terms of prehistoric burials, what I found was that a very, very high percentage of prehistoric burials were in chemically basic conditions. For example, in shell mounds, where the chemistry had a large role in preserving not only human bones, but also animal bones. Or if there was a large component of shell in the burial pit, there would be preservation of the bone.
Lauren, let me just stop you there only because we've got a lot of callers in. And do you have a specific question here?
No, I have an observation,
okay.
Which is that if you utilize an area that has very good drainage and does not have excessively base or excessively acidic conditions, your remains are going to decompose that much more rapidly.
Well, let me put that to Billy Campbell as someone who buries people for a living. What are your thoughts, Billy?
Well, I agree with him, and that's what I was saying about the soils in South Carolina being very acidic, and of course, with bone, the chemistry of bone being what it is, that the bones dissolve very quickly, so you don't get the preservation of bones as much as you might in a situation as he's describing.
Lauren, thanks for the call. Let me get Carolyn from Broomall to join us. And Carolyn, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for taking my call. This
sure.
is a very interesting topic.
Good.
I just wanted to bring up the area of eternal reefs, which my husband and I are planning to do. I don't need to describe it. I'm sure your experts could do that better than I could.
Well, it's a good point, and actually I'm pointing at Mark Harris because he writes about eternal reefs.
That's right. It's a great option. It's an option that creates a what they call a module or a reef structure. It's made out of about a ton of concrete mixed with a couple of pounds of human remains or cremated remains. Then those are cast into this module that is hollow in the middle. Looks like somebody's punched a dozen holes into it or so. It's left to dry. Then that eternal reef, that memorial reef, is then trucked up to various ports of call. And here, close off the coast of New Jersey, there are 15 established artificial reefs off coast that the State Department of Fish and Wildlife has created to attract aquatic wildlife. And so those memorial reefs are then deposited offshore onto that existing reef, augmenting it. And then when you dive on those reefs, a year or so after they've been deployed, you can see that there are sea fans, anemone, coral polyps all attaching to it. So you really are creating new habitat for life under the sea. Studies have shown that 800 times more aquatic life takes up residence there than the surrounding seafloor. So for those families who have some affinity for the sea, this is definitely a great way to quite literally give back.
Carolyn, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Billy, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, actually, interestingly, we know the Eternal Reef guys really well. One of the main guy lives within 18 miles of Ramsey Creek. And we've expressed interest and have explored the idea of having a terrestrial ecosystem linked to this underwater ecosystem. The fact most you look why people choose cremation. One of the top reasons is to save land, but you're not actively saving land or habitat. But this is a way to actively save land and habitat. So I think this or save habitat and create habitat. So I think it's a wonderful option.
Carolyn, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Mark, let me ask you about freeze drying. Where does that technology stand?
Well, this technology was rolled out at least 10 years ago by a woman in Sweden who had come up with a way to return the body to a compostable state. So, her process involves placing a body in a biodegradable casket and then submerging the casket and its occupant in liquid nitrogen, freeze-drying the remains, removing the liquid, and then reducing the body to a crumbly compost, which is then put into a cornstarch coffin and then buried in a shallow grave. Her idea is to return the body really to a compostable state, which can be taken up by the soil. So she's been looking to roll this out for, a good decade or so, and I know that she's trying to make headway in Sweden and has talked about introducing it in the UK. I know there are a number of families who have chose or ready to pursue this option, but at last observation, I don't think that she's gotten the permits yet.
And is that just because of the chemical process used, or we're talking about cutting edge tech? cutting-edge technology here?
I think that's it. I mean, I don't think we know what to make of it yet. So so there are those permitting permitting issues as we explore what actually is entailed in the process.
Let me see what looks like Brian from Philadelphia has to say. And Brian, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, good morning,
good
Marty.
Morning.
Wonderful topic.
Thank
and
you.
One that I actually enjoy discussing.
you and
about
us both.
15 years ago, when my dad passed away, we went to the funeral home, and my dad had said, I guess jokingly, but with some seriousness in life, bury me in a pine box. So when we got there, we said, you know, do you have a pine box? And the funeral director said, well, a lot of people say that they really don't mean it. And I said, no, you know, my dad meant it. I think we want a pine box. And he said, well, it would be difficult to get. He said, but here's something we can show you. And he takes us to a polished mahogany casket that looked nicer than my dad's car, and I think at the time it was about $10,000.
Wow.
But I know we felt empowered because of what he had said through the years, so we were persistent, and we did manage to get the second least expensive casket, which I believe was $1,700, and it was all wood. And then we actually hacked up the laundry list of things that we didn't realize were not required by law. And he said, you know, the blanket will cost you $150, and I said, well, you know, do we need that? And we actually brought our own Afghan that my dad used to wrap himself in. And then he said, you need a nameplate on the casket. I said,
And Brian, we're losing you on your cell phone, but I appreciate the call, and I want to give Billy Campbell a chance to respond to this. Is it hard to get a simple pine box?
Well, not anymore. And there's some companies that, you know, Jewish caskets basically are the same type of thing. If you look at way Jewish people are buried, Muslims, if they use if you use a casket, so they're widely available. You can also use these reinforced cremation caskets, but I do want to quickly share that one of the things, when my dad died, we tried to get him a plain pine box, and at the funeral home they didn't have it. But they said, we do have one of Spanish oak, and I said, well, if that's the only wooden casket you have, we'll get it, and mm-hmm. it was expensive. And to comfort me, he said, well, that's the same model that Dan Blocker was buried in, that's Hoth Cartwright. So it didn't really make me feel much better about the situation, but thanks. You know.
Yeah, no, I hear. That was from Bonanza, right?
Right.
You know, I think we're showing our age here. And Mark, you want to weigh in on the pine box?
Oh, yeah. You know, most of us think that we have to buy a big box from the funeral home. But in fact, you know, not only do we not have to buy a casket, we can make it ourselves. We can go to the local carpenter, have one built. We can get a cardboard container from the local crematory if we want. You know, at a fraction of the cost, we can go on the internet. You can go to the Costco retailer and get the plain pine box that you want. And if you are using a funeral home to handle your arrangements, the funeral director by law must accept your third party casket and may not charge you a handling fee to do so. Mm. So you know, certainly when you go to the funeral home, I think what I emphasize in my book is that we have a lot of choices that we can make, and you know, we end up making these decisions that were to spend anywhere from $10,000 to $12,000, you know, based on a lot of ignorance, and we don't make these arrangements all the time, but in fact, you know, we do have a lot of choice.
Well, we are talking about burying bodies today on Radio Times, talking about going green, and again, Mark Harris is our guest. He's got a new book called Grave Matters, A Journey Through the Modern Funeral Industry to a Natural Way of Burial. And on the telephone is Billy Campbell. He's the founder and president of Memorial Ecosystems and Ramsey Creek Preserve. Ramsey Creek, the first conservation burial site in the country. And we have a full bank of calls here. We'll take a very short break and then get back to our conversation and our callers. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Lancaster City Arts is proud to support WHYY. Lancaster City Arts, 125 art venues, all within one walkable community. From galleries, art studios, museums, and an art college, to music, poetry, dance, photography, professional theater, and symphony, it's an opportunity to experience something different in an art scene that's quite unexpected itself. Lancaster City Arts. The journey starts online at lancasterarts.com.
On the next Fresh Air, Afghanistan's brutal crime family, the Haqqani Network, which was behind the recent attack on the U.S. Embassy in Afghanistan. We talk with New York Times correspondent Mark Mazzetti. The network acts as a veritable arm of Pakistan's intelligence agency, according to Admiral Mike Mullen, the departing head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Join us.
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. The fertility industry has been in the news with reports that donors have produced dozens of offspring and concerns of accidental incest. We'll take a closer look. Also, Matterhorn author Carl Merlantis on the consequences of combat. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskowang. Like cars and buildings, burials are going green. And that's what we're talking about today on Radio Times with Billy Campbell joining us by telephone and Mark Harris here in our Philadelphia studios. Let me get, looks like Dawn from Orlando to join our conversation. And Dawn, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
I'm a member of Slow Food here in Orlando, and I'm an avid gardener and a chef. And the soil is really important to me, and as I'm listening to the conversation, I'm wondering what the embalming fluids are doing to the soil. And then after that, if you plant something where, you know, the green burials have happened, you know, a lot of people plant trees or something like that, what is that doing to the soil to affect what's growing on top of it?
Well, Dawn, two good questions. And Billy Campbell, do you want to take, I guess, the last part, which is, the effect of decomposing bodies on the natural habitat?
Well, we really think it probably is a positive thing. Where we are, the soils were, some of it was old cotton agriculture's depleted soils. A lot of the nutrients have been stripped or washed down into the creeks. And where we've had burials now for more than a decade, and I can tell you the plants do very well on some of the graves. And so the plants seem to be happy. As far as groundwater concerns, which comes up a lot, we had a groundwater engineer look at the issue, and certainly as far as surface waters, Ramsey Creek has a lot more trouble with cattle operations upstream. We just bought a mile of creek frontage that was going to be converted into a cattle ranch, Fortunately, that's not going to happen, so we think the water, we're pretty sure, is cleaner when it exits Ramsey Creek than when it enters the Ramsey Creek Preserve. But I think as far as the effects on the soil where we are, it certainly, if anything, is positive. By the way, it's very low density. Ramsey Creek in the original 33 acres, there'll only be 1,500 burials, where a contemporary cemetery might have 1,000 people per acre. So this is a much lower density.
Oh, that's very interesting. Mark, can you take the embalming fluid, her concerns about its impact on water and land?
Well, you know, the main component of embalming solutions is formaldehyde. That's the preservative, which is a proven carcinogen. Its effect is in the environment is unclear. The studies that I have seen that have looked at it have found trace amounts of formaldehyde leaching into the surrounding soil and groundwaters, but they can't definitively even trace that back to decomposing bodies. So I would say that it's not part of a green lifestyle or death style to be embalmed, but I can't say that formaldehyde's a smoking gun. Its effect is more evident on funeral directors who exhibit exhibit higher rates of certain kinds of cancer because of their regular exposure to formaldehyde, and I think, you know, before too long, formaldehyde as the main component of embalming fluids will be banned in this country.
But if a body with, you know, that has been embalmed is in one of these caskets, does anything leach out of that?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, these burial vaults are sold as, you know, the last line of defense against Mother Nature. But in fact, no burial vault is impermeable to the elements forever. I spoke to a couple of forensic scientists who have gone into, you know, graveyards to disinter remains for criminal cases, and they tell me that many of these burial vaults have cracks in the tops, and they open the top and they find out that these caskets are swimming in water because these burial vaults are not, impermeable to the elements. Same with metal caskets. You know, over time they will eventually be breached. The body will eventually break down. So, you know, I think the interesting thing is here we spend all this money to the tune of $10,000 to $12,000 to preserve a body, but it's only a short-lived phenomenon, and we're all eventually going to go back to the earth. Mother Nature will
dust
have her way
to dust,
in the end.
Dust to dust, yes. Right. Let me get Ross from Portland to join us on Radio Times. And Ross,
how are you doing?
Hi. Very well, thank you.
Good. I just wanted to ask your guests to make a comment afterwards. First off, did either of you read in the 1970s when I was in college the book called The American Way of Death that focused on forest lawn in California, which changed my whole thinking about burial. I tried to convince everyone I knew ever since then that we buried in a sheet in a cardboard box, but no one ever believed me. So I just wondered if they'd ever read that book. And sure. Otherwise, do most cemeteries allow one to be buried in a shallow grave with a sheet and a cardboard or pine box and mounded, or are they concerned about settling in the graveyard and everybody has to be in some sort of a vault underground?
Well, Russ, those are two good questions. And Billy Campbell, I'm going to toss them first to you. Go ahead.
Yeah, I actually read The American Way of Death in the mid-70s, and it probably was one of the very influential books and ideas that I got there for creating memorial ecosystems. I don't think what the second part of the question was. It was
whether in a non-green cemetery.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Do people also have options about a cardboard box, for instance, to use Ross's?
Some cemeteries do. There are a lot of hybrids that are beginning now, where people will put aside several acres. It's not a functioning nature preserve necessarily, but there are a growing number of cemeteries that are offering a few acres here and there. I think in Portland, if you're in Portland, Oregon, or Portland, Maine, but I know there's a cemetery in Portland near Lewis and Clark College that's going to be offering, I think, some opportunities for natural burial within their cemetery.
Mark, you want to weigh in on that?
Sure. If you go to your local cemetery, your cemetery is probably going to require a burial vault. But again, a burial vault is not required by law. But as you suggest in your comments, Ross, cemeteries generally require it because if you have a biodegradable casket and then you have its occupant both decaying over time with no burial vault, then you get the declivity that has to be filled in later on. So you're right; they're often required because of maintenance issues. That said, I would certainly ask your local cemetery if you want to be buried there whether or not you can be buried in a vaultless grave or if you can use a vault that's been turned upside down with no bottom so that at least the casket or even just the shrouded burial will be able to decay and rejoin the elements without worrying about the top of the burial vault decaying and causing
I never thought of that.
Yeah, and some cemeteries will allow you to do that.
Can you talk briefly about burial at sea while we're talking about various ways to think about one's burial?
Yes. Certainly when we talk about burial at sea, most of what we're talking about is sea scattering. So there are plenty of companies that will help you go out to the required 3-mile limit, at least on the eastern coast, and then scatter at sea. Whole body burial is also perfectly legal, but then you also need to go out to that 3-mile limit. Mm-hmm. You've got a casket in many cases, and you're required by the EPA and to go out that far and then to place the body in a container that will sink to the bottom of the seafloor.
You can't just wrap a sheet or something.
No, and in fact, there was a pretty famous case already, a year or two ago, where a body that had been deposited illegally off coast then showed up, on the coast of North Carolina, wrapped still in the same, garden shed sheet that it was wrapped in. So the whole idea is to get the body not just out into the ocean, but to the ocean floor. If you're a member of the military, active duty military, and their dependent families can have whole body burial by military transport for free. But the military has the requirement that the body be embalmed, to be placed in a metal casket that's weighted with concrete, holes are bored into the top, and then there are metal bands. So you go back to the earth, but it's not exactly the greenest way to go.
I hear you. Let me get Daniel from Newtown to join our conversation. And Daniel, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Good, good. It's actually the second person you've had today who works in archaeology and anthropology on the phone today. I was curious, with all of the discussion about the laws and the influence of the state on the rules of alternative and green burial, have you ever run into any issues regarding religion or religious groups saying that you can or can't do certain processes?
Daniel, I'm going to toss that to Billy Campbell.
Well, actually, natural burial is very consistent with just about all traditions, and in fact, I would maintain that the dust-to-dust burial is more consistent with with, you know, Judeo-Christian religions, and as far as other religions, we really haven't had one so far that where embalming or preserving the body was a major issue. We actually have, at Ramsey Creek, we were surprised. We have a fair number of evangelical Christians and even very conservative Christian groups who are very old-timey here in the mountains that we service their families, and they've had several burials there. So it was a big surprise to us that we were expecting all the granola crunching people like me, and it turned out we got we have quite a clientele of very conservative Christians.
Well, that's a very integrated cemetery that you have down there by politics, I guess. Mark, anything else you want to add to that?
Well, you know, if you consider cremation one of these green strategies, of course, there are certain religions, you know, the Hindus who believe that it's important that you cremate the body to liberate that spirit. So then you have cremated remains, which then can be returned to a natural environment.
Let me see what Joy from Ardmore has to say. And Joy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi.
Thanks so much for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
This is a great topic. It seems like there's a lot to figure out in advance. Everything seems to be set up for non-green burials. So what I wanted to know was, if you don't want to be embalmed, what do you need to know? You don't have a lot of time. How do you work with the hospital, with the cemetery, and does the funeral home still play a part in this?
Mark, I guess I'm looking at you, but Billy, I want to hear from you as well. Go ahead, Mark.
Well, you know, you're right. There's a lot going on, and there's a short amount of time to get it done. So, I mean, that's why I would encourage everybody to start thinking about this now and actually write down your directives, your end-of-life directives, what you want to have done. I did that myself after I wrote this book. I thought, wow, if I drop dead tomorrow, my wife has no idea what needs to happen. So, number one, you need to know your state and local laws. You know, if you want to file the death certificate, where do you get the death certificate? From the local registrar. If you don't want to be embalmed, so do you want to have a home funeral? What does that mean? You're going to lay the body out for a couple of days. You're going to need, in the state of Pennsylvania, requires that you have either refrigeration or embalming, you know, after 24 hours. So then you need to get the dry ice, which is also an improved form of preservation. You know, your casket, where are you going to get your casket? Are you going to have somebody make it? I have a picture here in the slideshow that I present around the country of people who have made caskets and turned them into bookcases and, you know, coffee tables. And
is that what I'm looking at right here?
That's what you're looking at now. Has the handles on the side to remind you of what the final use is for. Yes, it's important to get all of these issues, you know, planned out in advance. I would encourage you to get in touch with the Funeral Consumer Alliance, the FCA. That's a national organization that has local chapters around the country. There's one in Philadelphia, in which they know the local laws and can help you set up these directives in advance. Because yes, the clock is kind of ticking, and you're not in the greatest shape after somebody has passed away, and you've got a lot of decisions to make, and it could be quite expensive if you don't. If you don't do it right.
So what did you decide to do with your body?
Well, you know, I'm working with a group that is working to establish a green section to an existing cemetery, and that's where I think at this point, mm-hmm. would like to be returned. It's near my home, but so that's it. So I just need to hold on until we get that established.
Billy Campbell, you're the founder, president of this green conservation burial site. You're also associate director of a local hospice down there in South Carolina. It's hard to talk about death, and it's hard to talk about death when someone is dying. How do you suggest people think about some of the things that we've been talking about?
Well, in addition to maybe talking to a local providers, local cemetery, funeral homes, because often the funeral home is generally still involved. We have a fair number of families who have handled things themselves. That requires a lot more preparation. But we have a local preferred provider, but if people want to use another provider, they probably should try to make arrangements, even if you don't prepay, at least sort it out. And I can tell you, it's very important to talk to the family. We've had clients who have decided this is what they want to do, and they've not spoken to their family, and maybe some of the family members don't get it, and there's been some unpleasantness where this is what mom wanted, but there's a grandchild who feels this is in some way offensive or doesn't really understand the process of natural burial. So I strongly suggest talking to the family in addition to either pre-planning or you can even purchase the place ahead of time. I'd say the majority of the people we buried at Ramsey Creek have not been a spur of the moment. We've had people who have had car accidents and other sudden deaths, a fair number, but you do have to kind of scramble if you haven't thought of it ahead of time.
Indeed. Final question here, and actually, Mark, I'm going to toss this to you. I'm looking at something, someone who spoke at a TED conference earlier this year, and these conferences are great because they put ideas out that you might not have thought of. And this is an artist, an inventor, who, and I'm just quoting from her, she's wanting to create something called an infinity mushroom. And I'll just quote her, "I thought I could train a toxic-cleaning edible mushroom to eat my body." And this is how she, I guess, envisioned her death and what would happen to her body after she died.
You know, it's interesting as this natural burial movement catches on, there are all these strategies being rolled out from, you know, freeze-drying the remains to this resummation to this thing. And I, you know, I've talked to a lot of funeral directors and I've said, this is coming. So if you want to get on the train, I would start offering at least some of these strategies or caskets in your funeral home. But, you know, listen, you know, what attracted me most and what attracts me most about natural burial is that if you bury a body in a ground and you do nothing, it will decay. It will rejoin the elements. It will push up a tree. At Ramsey Creek, which is one of the most beautiful cemeteries you'll ever see, the funds from your burial are going back to preserve a woodland that your family can go and return to, and they can reconnect with nature, and they could see a part of you quite literally live on. So, you know, that's the magic of natural burial. It, you know, green burial happens.
Well, and that's Mark Harris, author of a book called Grave Matters, and Billy Campbell. He is the founder and president of Memorial Ecosystems and Ramsey Creek Preserve that we've been talking about. Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having us.
You're very welcome.
All right.
And we appreciate those phone calls. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program, including Facebook and Twitter. You can also check out the archives and go to our webpage as well. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.